Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Dear listeners, welcome back to New Books in Urban Studies. This is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Anna Zhelnina, the host of the channel, and this interview is being done in partnership with the city, with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. And joining me today are Ross Beveridge and Philippe Koch. We are going to talk about their new book, How Cities Can Transform Democracy. It was published in 2022 by John Wiley and Sons. Ross and Philippe, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
And let's start with the introductions. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ross. I'm a senior lecturer in urban studies at the University of Glasgow.
And hi, my name is Philippe Koch, and I'm a professor in urban politics in Winterthur at the ZHAW.
And congratulations to you both for publishing this highly interesting and timely book. My first question is, how did you come up with the idea for the project, and why did you write this together?
Will you start?
Well, I think it was probably like most books had a long sort of gestation period. We were a little bit surprised in some ways that no one had written a book about democracy and urbanization. I think we both have roots in studying political science. I wouldn't say we are political scientists now, at least. You know, we certainly probably wouldn't fit into political science. We were a bit kind of dissatisfied with political science's reluctance to engage with cities and urbanization. And then I think on the other side of the coin, within urban studies, particularly urban geography, which has been very kind of dominant in the engagement with urbanization, there was a lot of work around justice and some work around democracy, but not really taking it to the that kind of intricate analysis of how democracy might be related to urbanization. Some people are doing that. Mark Purcell and Clive Barnett wrote about it, but there wasn't really a big debate about it. And I think that kind of made us wonder why. And then, you know, then we sort of spent quite a long time trying to come up with a way of engaging those two things, you know, democracy and urbanization. And we wrote some articles together, and it took some time. It came out of this kind of process and kind of toing and froing and circling around these ideas, I think.
And it was also a nice way to, I guess, stay in touch and to work together.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the book, I think we also thought that we didn't want to write articles about it. I mean, I think tried to write some articles about it that were more or less successful. The book, I think, provides obviously a bit more of a broader palette and And I think it's nice for us to do it most of the time. It was nice, you know. And Philip's mainly in Zurich, I was mainly in Glasgow or sometimes in Berlin, so it was lots of Zoom conversations. But it was a way of connecting, particularly during some of the pandemic time as well. You know, that was another background factor.
So did you write this book for fellow academics, or who is your imagined audience for this project? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the focus is surely on the academic debate or the scholarly debate, but we also, I think that was one reason why we wrote that book and not a series of articles, is that we thought that when we could write a book, it could be more accessible also for activists, maybe politicians, and more lay people. And I think the first kind of responses we get can point in that direction. So it's not only that scholars read the book or are interested in the book, but also, activists and people who are kind of interested in how urbanization and the city might play a role in future democratic struggles. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was immediately intrigued when I just saw the title of your book, because it kind of sets it up in a very unusual way. Often people talk about how democracy can be a useful tool to transform cities and change how people live in cities, but you kind of reverse the relationship and talk about how cities can transform democracy. So can you explain your approach a little bit more?
I think, I'll have the first go at it. The impetus for framing it in that way was that we thought there is a debate on the political implications of urbanization, and there is a debate around what politics looks like if you frame it outside of the nation state, and what urbanization is doing to the nation state, of course, is a big debate across social sciences. And our jumping off point was to say, well, if urbanization is transformative in relation to cities, and if it's really if it provides a different frame for thinking about politics, then what are the implications of that for democracy? And I think for us then is this idea that there are many ways of looking at politics, and one really productive, and it would seem from what lots of activists are doing, and certainly lots of scholars are pointing us in that way, is to think about politics from the perspective of this process of urbanization, and also perhaps as a different kind of landscape of politics, one which is not connected to institutions in the state or not centered on that, but is really some kind of project of social life, of everyday life, of connections between people. I think that was this idea of seeing like a city, which comes from the political theorist Warren Magnuson, who took the idea initially from, so turning on the head of this idea from James Scott about seeing like a state, where the state kind of looks down and organizes society and rationalizes. And Magnuson's argument was that the state has come to dominate and distort political inquiry, because we always end up looking at the state or only at the state. And his argument was that, you know, politics is much more than that. And indeed, the most kind of useful way of thinking about politics would be to imagine it in terms of this kind of city metaphor or ontology. So that's one aspect. And I suppose the other aspect is that urbanization really does seem to be, particularly at the geography debates, really driving all these different changes to political authority. And I don't know if you want to add something around urbanization, Philip.
Maybe on a more general note, I think we live in a time of extreme democratic crisis, and I think there are different approaches to that, and I think some people try to kind of build better institutions within the existing institutions, but they kind of stick to this institutional and state-centric vision of democracy, and I think over the last 10 years or 12 years or since we're doing research, we always had this kind of a critical relation to this strictly institutional-centric, state-centric vision. And I think what we try to do is also to try to find a new kind of approach to democracy or a new vocabulary of democracy coming from an urban studies perspective. And I think Ross already mentioned Farron Markinson, but he had this kind of interesting quote. It goes in the sense of that most people are trying to scale urban life to the existing like political jurisdictions, and maybe it would be more appropriate or more interesting to invent a democratic politics around what is already there in urban life. And I think that's kind of the more general motivation that we had at the beginning. And of course, in terms of urbanization, I think there is a lot kind of debate going on. What is the meaning of the city anyway, when urbanization kind of transforms all these seemingly traditional urban forms? And at the same time, you can see a lot of people claiming rights to the city or evoking the city as a democratic and political claim, and we wanted to kind of negotiate those or bring into dialogue those two standpoints to a certain extent, like a conceptual way of thinking about that. But then you have also these empirical examples that we came across, and we wanted to bridge those differences, I guess.
So if you had to define politics and democracy, and you spent quite a lot of time in the book working with the definitions of those two concepts, like if you had to define them, what would that be? How do you define politics and democracy in your book?
Well, I think our goal was to a certain extent to provide, first of all, a theorization of democracy through an urban lens. And that means to think of democracy more as a through the practices, or democracy as a practice-based political action. And it's not something that you can locate in institutions, but that something that is experienced and learned and crafted. So it's really, it goes back to or is related to kind of a radical tradition of democratic thinking, inspired by people like Sheldon Woolin, but also others. So it's we understand democracy not as a relation between state and a citizen, but more like the relation between people and places. It's about self-government and not so much about sovereignty. So I think we, in the book, we don't provide a one-sentence definition of democracy. It's more like opening up different registers to think about democracy. Maybe Ross, do you want to add something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what was crucial in the book is this notion of collective life or urban collective life as the horizon, as we call it, on which politics and then therefore democracy takes place. So that really is putting it in this context in which it's about the interactions between people and then democracy then becomes how the demos forms in these contexts, in these interactions between people, how collective organizations and collective decision-making occurs. And that doesn't exclude the state. It just puts this, it decenters the state. That's the argument we make. And I think that's quite, has quite big implications for politics. And people have written about that in the past, of course. And, you know, urbanization is often seen to be driving a decentering of the state. But I think less people have written about this decentering of the state in relation to urban democracy in recent times. So I think we saw our contribution there as really taking it to the next, sort of taking the argument a little bit further to consider how democracy is, as a project of urban everyday life. In one sentence, although we don't really have one sentence definition, but if we were to be pushed, then I think that would be the kind of accessible way of defining it.
Yeah, and I think that when you put practices in a kind of the center of the study of democracy and also the and also the everyday life of democracy, then you have to think about the material condition and the environment where these practices actually occur. So practices are always located somewhere. And that's certainly when you look at political science engagement with democracy and partly also political theory engagement with democracy, it's often a democracy without the physical world and the material world. It's often a literature without places, concrete sites. Maybe apart from parliaments and government meeting rooms, and that's also something that we wanted to kind of bring in into this debate around democracy. So if you think of democracy as a located practice, something that is happening and negotiated within urban collective life, then you have to think about materialities and how they kind of are generative of political action and democratic engagement, but also put some limits of what you can do or how you can relate to transformations. I think that's certainly like the way we want, or the approach we want to take, go away from institutions, more to practices and democracy certainly as a form of sovereign government, but also democracy as a mode of experience and everyday engagement.
I mean, I think just the last thing to say on that, I mean, there are these big debates about kind of political disenchantment, disenchantment with democratic politics, formal politics. This kind of almost this sense of alienation from politics, and if you put it in the terms that we do in the book, I mean, it is quite understandable in a way, because politics seems detached from everyday life. It's a realm on its own. And and I suppose in some ways you could read the book. It wasn't really entirely written like that, but one reading of the book is that it's trying to overcome this kind of slightly sterile debate that often occurs between people saying, formal politics might not be perfect, but it's better than having all these forms of disconnected, messy participation and people on the street, and you can't sustain democracy through that. And I suppose that's a challenge we take up in the book, to say, well, actually, what would it look like if you did have a project of democracy which wasn't relying on the state, even if it was engaging with the state in representative politics as it was doing that. And in the book, we call that project that democratic project the project of the city. You know, so we have this alternative imaginary, alternative to the nation and the state, an imaginary which is based on collective life and the kind of common ownership and engagement with the idea of a place. You know, the city is an idea, and cities, of course, is actual places. You know, Helsinki or Zurich or Glasgow or wherever, and. So that's our way of providing some kind of sense that there's a project, and even if there's diversity and is messy and it's not institutionalized, it it has a coherence and a meaning, and has first and foremost overcomes this alienation, the sense of alienation in relation to politics and democracy, because it reinserts it in everyday life.
Yeah, and I think what we also were aiming at was to what Ross just mentioned is that there is not this binary vision of democracy either fully within state institutions or outside state institutions, but they're always kind of in relation to each other. So our kind of what we call kind of this urban democracy is not something outside of the state or inside of the state, but has different relations to the state. And I think that's why we also dedicated one chapter to this question, because we think it is extremely important at this point of time that we not only think about political action on the streets in urban areas, but also how we comprehend the state as such, as not this monolithic block, but as a kind of a decentral political authority with different access points, so to say. And so it makes everything a bit messier and more complicated, also in conceptual terms, because you cannot rely on this binary, but it makes it also more interesting and more maybe optimistic, because you have different ways into this area where a lot of state resources are distributed and decided upon without necessarily going through this electoral circle. And I think that's, yeah.
Yeah, I hope we can return to this question of the state a little bit later, because I think it's a really important one. But before we go there, I still wanted to talk about the city and the importance of the city a little bit more. So why does it matter? I really appreciated the way you talked about democracy as a localized practice, but why does it matter that it's the cities that we're talking about? So what is urban about those processes, those democratic processes for you?
I think that that's the most controversial part of the book, that we insist on saying the city is important for democracy, because well, maybe first of all, what is really striking in when you kind of engage with these scholarly debates, and especially this interdisciplinary debates around definitions and understandings of the city and urban, is that every discipline has a completely different understanding of those terms. And we come from a quite interdisciplinary background, I would say. I started as political scientist, but kind of detached from that and went more into sociology and architecture and urban planning. And it's quite difficult to find a common language around it. So the city, for some, is just an urban form, kind of a precise one. And then for political scientists, it's just a political jurisdiction, like municipalities and stuff like that. And from a sociological point of view, it's really like a way of life, maybe, and different sets of civic organizations apart from the countryside, or just a moment in urbanization for a lot of geographers. And that's a huge debate, and it's complicated and difficult to kind of, again, to pinpoint it down. But what our main contribution or idea is that the city is always kind of a also symbolic space, and at the same time, or a virtual space, and at the same time, an actual space. So the city has these kind of different meanings, and because of these different meanings and associations that are formed in everyday life, but also from scholarly debates, that generates kind of this engagement, this democratic engagement. And that's on the level of discourses, but it is also on the level of the lived spaces of people, because they want to be part of the city in the sense of they want to have a voice in what happens around them in the public spaces and houses. And often these struggles are framed as a claim for the city. And I think that's something we cannot just dismiss. So we have to stick to to a project and give it a name, and cities is certainly a name that is evokes a lot of kind of positive and also controversial associations.
I think also excuse me, I think also democracy, like any political project, needs a location, a place, and you know, so it's not just this localized action. It's also more an idea of a territory or a horizon, as we call it in the book. And as Philip said, there's the city has something really productive in that it has this imagined or this imaginary dimension, in the sense that it's an idea of people being together in a place. Can be sort of something that you aspire to, that you work towards, and then it also has this the sense of actually being rooted in a place, this materiality, and this interaction between this virtual and actual, and material and ideational is really powerful, we think, and so that to us overrides some of the doubts that scholars in urban studies have about that. And one thing to be very clear is it's not a resurrection of the city as a state. We're very clear that, you know, that vision of the city is not what we're interested in at all. It's much more this notion of being in common, or the urban commons, as it's sometimes called. All these kind of ideas seem to be sort of floating around, suggesting that the city is something that can be a democratic project. And I think what we do in the book is take that seriously and try to develop an argument and a vocabulary around the city as a democratic project.
Which is also kind of conceptually sound. I think it's one aspect to say the city has still kind of political purchase in struggles, and for most people, urbanites across the globe, when you would say, well, that's something, the city is this or that, it seems quite obvious that the city for them exists. It's not something that the city still has kind of an everyday value as a term. It's so obvious that it should exist, and at the same time we acknowledge that the city is not something that is just there. It has changed. Urbanization completely transformed at least the urban form, but often also ways of life. And so this kind of tension, one could try to just ignore this tension, and what we try to is be engage with it productively. And what is necessary to say is, it's what one point, as Ross already mentioned, that we don't want to can bring back the European city of the 18th, 19th century. And another point is that we don't put the city in opposition to a countryside. So the city is really kind of this a representation of urbanization. It's really an imaginary, and it's not something that you can pinpoint as a specific urban form in opposition to something else. So it's more something, a representation of urbanization, which serves a specific purpose, namely to organize and to kind of bring people together and to engage. So in this sense, it is kind of the product of urbanization.
I think it's so interesting that, as you already mentioned, that it's so difficult to kind of capture conceptually and theoretically why it still makes sense to talk about cities and to kind of emphasize this urban dimension. But then when you talk about specific examples like urban movements, almost everyone agrees that these are urban phenomena, right? And it's easy to think about them as urban. So it's an interesting dilemma or an interesting puzzle how to deal with those things. And I appreciated how you talked about it in the book quite openly. But now I want to move on to the specific cases in the book. So you do quite a lot of theoretical work, but you also talk about specific cases or situations when people try to engage in urban democracy. And I wanted you to talk about a little bit about those cases, how you selected them, and why. So what makes those particular cases transformative as political practices?
Well, I think the first thing to say about the cases is they're really useful in revealing the contingency of the city as a democratic project. And that's one thing we really emphasize in the book, which we haven't perhaps stated thus far, is that we argue on the one hand that this democratic project is emerging. You know, we can see it in cities, what activists and some governments are doing, and we try to sort of deal with the implications of that in the book and sort of stretch it and say, well, how can we then imagine that as providing us with an alternative horizon of democracy? And I think the examples we ended up choosing were ones which really showed this rootedness of politics in social material contexts. So it was really, we had this idea of people, places, and practices as being kind of what the example should revolve around, as revealing of this kind of project of everyday life. And the examples that we chose, I mean, we don't ultimately I don't think we chose any real sort of classic social movement type examples, but rather examples which for us somehow embodied or revealed a kind of or were suggestive of this idea of the city with people as people in common. So the examples that we have are the first main sort of empirical chapter is housing cooperatives and self-government, this key urban resource. So how that actually works, and that's examples from Zurich, but also from Berlin and where else? Los Angeles, and some from Latin America as well. And so that was really about how the democracy again occurs in these kind of places, and is something that is related to home and dwelling, and is close to home, and it should be embedded in these processes. And then the second empirical chapter is more wide ranging, and is more sort of trying to capture the range of practices which occur in cities, which sometimes are considered political and sometimes aren't. And our purpose there, we were looking at examples in relation to critical mass, the cycling group, a cycling movement. I wouldn't say it's a classical social movement. Alongside a very varied and more obviously political practices of claiming space for, you know, to build property. So thinking, we draw examples then from the global south of people claiming space and claiming homes, building homes, and as an act of citizenship, as this really a claiming to the right to the city. In context of austerity, this very similar kind of processes of claiming citizenship and a reasonable life, also in the European context. And I may have missed some in that chapter. There were quite a few examples. I think then the third empirical chapter looks at the question of the state, and there we deal with the movements that have been termed the new municipalism. So we look at examples like Barcelona, Preston, Jackson, Mississippi, and Naples. And there it's much more about how democracy is located apart from, but always in relation to the state. And there the point is that there's no kind of nirvana beyond the state, in our view at least, even if the state isn't never, in fact, the host or the harbinger of democracy. So I think what we try to do with those three sets of examples is, in the first case, to delineate democracy as self-government rather than sovereignty. That's really what all of them do that, but the housing one's really doing that to show that this democratic project is one of urban places and urban life. And the second set of examples around these different varied practices of claiming space, occupying space, being together in space with other people is about citizenship. It's about collectively becoming a public, part of a public, you know, making a claim to urban space or making a claim to the city. And becoming a citizen. So that's this notion that democracy is really about becoming a political being. That's what Boland says, I think. So it has something where it's transformative of self. But as we emphasize in the book, it's always in a context with others, with other people. And then I suppose the purpose of the last empirical chapter is to deal with that really vexed question of what do you do with the state? How does a project exist? It's not only a strategic question, it's also a theoretical question. And we think that the new municipalist movements of the last 5 to 10 years, which were in turn took inspiration from urban local politics in Latin America in the early 2000s, really instructive in how the state can be engaged with as a democratic project, you know, showing limitations as well as potentialities. So I think what we try to do there is to plot a path forward. It's not to say that we have all the answers, but it's to deal with some of the kind of theoretical and strategic political questions which might occur to people when we suggest that democracy is this project of collective urban life.
Yeah, I think you said most of the things that need to be said, but what I wanted to add is I think what is interesting is that that there are some political actions or practices that are somehow on the fringe of being political or democratic. And that was certainly one point that we wanted to, or what we were interested in, are these kind of actions which are not so obviously kind of in a mainstream common sense in scholarly debates, where you could say, ah, of course that's democratic, and of course that's not democratic, or that is political or not political. We wanted to go there where it is more gray than black and white. And I think we decided on these cases and examples that we've already studied before, but also strategically try to evaluate how these what happens in this gray zone, what we can learn from that. And critical mass is certainly such an example, which we did not choose because of its political import or kind of success, but more as what does it symbolize, what is actually happened there. And so we also kind of took examples where which are not the ones who can that you can scale up, to use that language easily, but which are instructive in a conceptual way. But we also the kind of the strategy for selecting these examples is also that we said there is a widespread use, or the practices are quite widespread across different domains. It's not just one there or here, but it's already part of most everyday lives of urbanites across the globe. So it's a democracy already practiced, but not so much theorized, we would say.
Yeah, I think just one more point in relation to that. I think that that can be seen against the background of these big debates around what, not just what democracy is, but what politics is or what the political is, which has been a big discussion in urban studies the last 10 to 15 years with obviously the work by Eric Swindegar and post-political and the kind of debates that prompted. And we don't directly engage with that, but I think our argument has some similarities with what Julianne Boudreau argues in her book on global urban politics, that, you know, political action or transformative political action has to be both heroic, you know, it is often about these big contests, or it's about people really putting themselves on the line for causes and coming together in struggles. But it's also post-heroic. So there's an element of it being part and being already entwined with everyday practices and everyday life. And I think what we think is really instructive about the examples that we have, we've got kind of trying to get to the real essence of it now after having spoken around it for a few minutes, is that they really bring us closer to this sense again that a democracy doesn't have to be something that is out of our reach. It can really be something that, or doesn't have to be separated and talked about in terms of our politics. You know, it really is something that we can kind of just reimagine in terms of lots of stuff that's already happening or how our lives are governed. And we somehow just need to have that switch of perspectives. And that's I think what we try to do in the book, is try to turn some of these conventional notions of, first of all, politics, and then second of all, democracy, to turn them on their head and say, well, if you look at it slightly differently, democracy, you know, it is about home building, and I can't think of any of the other examples now, but you know, it is something that is something that people can relate to, in a more intuitive way, I suppose, than kind of a formalized politics of representation in institutions.
That also, it also switches kind of this question that is often treated in more debates around participatory democracies. There, the question is often, how can citizens participate in the urban development or urban projects? And one could also switch this question and say, how, when, and under what conditions can planners or politicians participate in urban everyday life? And then you kind of acknowledge that urban everyday life has already a kind of a productive and generative force. And that's, these examples kind of serve also this purpose, to see and to demonstrate what is happening and what has already been done. And that is not just a pre-sequel to the real politics, but that's kind of the tissue which kind of enables different forms of politics.
Could you maybe talk a little bit more about how you analyze the case of the critical mass? Because housing struggles, it kind of makes sense intuitively that they would be very important for urban democracy and right to the city and all of these things. But I was honestly surprised to see critical mass as one of your examples. And I thought, this was an interesting analysis. So maybe you could just give our listeners a sense of what you do with this example in the book.
Well, I think a critical mass in the first instance is interesting because everybody is kind of grappling with it, and nobody knows how to locate it. Is it kind of a social movement? Is it just a party of individuals coming together by kind of randomly? And that kind of was interesting to us. And then we get to know or realize that there is also kind of this legal debate. So what is it actually? And you can see also the judges are grappling with that question. And often it is then argued that it is not a political manifestation. but it is something that happens just in the everyday, and it's kind of an extreme form of urban collective life, one could argue, and also something that is, of course, it is situated. It happens in one moment or 2 or 3 hours, and then it disappears again. But in these 2 or 3 hours, this mass of people who are not really connected to each other, which have no organizational form, change not only how we can move through the city, but also how we experience the city and experience the possibilities of engaging in a physical and social way with the city. So it's really relieving in this in between space, in these gray zones, what is possible, and still it's not really an answer or a solution to a problem. It is more like a way of thinking the political through a different kind of register. I think that these are certainly kind of one or two aspects that we thought was interesting.
I think also the critical mass example is really instructive. I mean, in addition to what Philip just said, I think it really challenges conventional understandings of what politics is in relation to the state. It really challenges the state. If we put to one side the actual productivity of critical mass itself, if you imagine just that people coming together in the city, not necessarily claiming or demanding something overtly, but obviously prefiguring a different form of a life within that city. In this case, cycling, but it could be something else. It could be, it really is like a demos coming together in a place and performing something. And some of the examples in the book, I think, in relation to London, where some of the early or the critical mass movements of maybe around 10 years ago were taken to court by the Metropolitan Police in London, and the case was the judge essentially ruled that this wasn't really, like, couldn't be treated as a political gathering because it didn't conform to what the law said was a political gathering, and so it was something else. It was a gathering, but it wasn't a political gathering. And we thought that was really, really instructive and allowed us to develop some of these ideas about how the demos, how we might imagine the demos in so material terms coming together in the city.
And it's also somewhere in between, because it's obvious for every observer of critical mass, and when you're taking part of a critical mass, it's obvious that it has a political kind of not a political message, but it has a political meaning. But it's impossible to say what the political meaning actually is, because there is not one voice who's calling out something. But and then you have this kind of this level on when critical mass actually happens in one location, then you have all these negotiations with car drivers, which forces those participants of the critical mass to engage in a political negotiation, which happens at this place and not in a parliament. And that's something really revealing about an urban lens on democracy. I think that's what happens a lot throughout the world. And this judge ruling in London was replicated by different, or you have the similar kind of struggles in Switzerland when they try to treat critical mass. It's not, they don't know how to treat it. And that's really interesting.
I think also the example in that chapter opens up into other examples, and we use it as a way of, if that's a way of imagining a public, an urban public forming, one that doesn't have sort of boundaries, whether they're institutional or ideological or whatever, if it's something that's difficult to grasp, that's instructive of how democracy is. We don't argue in the book that democracy only has to be like that. The term democracy is always just bursting into life and then disappearing. But we do think that it will inevitably have this fluctuating character of people coming together and then coming apart. And that's partly, I think, what we try to illustrate in the last chapter in relation to the Glasgow example with the protests to prevent the removal of two refugees in the south side of the city, and how people invoked notions of the city in relation to what happened, and how people sort of seemed to come together. You know, like obviously there was organization involved. You know, there was a network of activists involved, but also people came from their houses, their flats, to see what was happening as a crowd formed, and then there was a standoff between the police and then the Home Office were trying to deport them, and then the protesters. And for us, this is really, again, another one of these moments that came together. But of course, then it subsided and disappeared. The two men, thankfully, weren't deported. And then we tried to deal with the consequences of a democracy which works like that in this kind of fluctuating character. And I think that tension runs through the book quite a lot, and we don't have a single answer for it, but we do argue that there's a contingency to it, that there has to be also an opportunistic dimension to democracy. And democracy if it is in this realm of collective urban life, then it's not some imagined, idealized world. The state's already there. Capital's already there working and transforming space. And it will have to engage with these forces. And it won't necessarily aspire to institutions, but it will be. It could become a part of institutional politics, always kind of returning and coming away. So I think in that sense, the examples do interlink, and the critical mass one is a way of jumping off and saying, well, this is how do you, this is the beginning of the journey in a way. You know, if urban democracy is worth its name, then it's going to have something which really challenges our conventional understandings of what democracy would be. And of course, lots of people would then argue that that's precisely why we don't want that kind of democracy. It's why we need institutions and we need the state to stabilize and repeat. And I think, you know, through the other examples we have and the way we connect to them, we argue against that, I think, and we counter that in hopefully quite convincing ways.
And where do those classic urban social movements fit in this picture? So what makes a practice or an initiative, a situation transformative? Are all of the social movements transformative? What would you say to that?
Yeah, that's a difficult question because there's so many different kind of way into it and so many different also studies and approaches to urban social movements. But I think transformative is how we understand transformative is not something that is only aimed at in terms of institutions that should be transformed. So a transformation can be momentous, can be one moment or can be one area or can be one collective which has or undergoes a transformation. And I think urban social movements often are, I would consider them often as part of the same struggle for an urban democracy, but some urban social movements are also more directed towards making claims towards politicians and the state, and don't engage in an immediate fashion with the urban environment, and don't kind of provide social grounding so that publics emerge and locate and take root somewhere. So it's difficult. I wouldn't say that they don't exclude one another, but it's a different angle to it, I would say.
And maybe we could now go back to this question of the state that we mentioned a little bit earlier, and in relation to all those different ways how people can engage with the state to address various urban problems. So how do you work with the notion of the state? And the question that I also had, does it matter what kind of the state we're talking about? The one that's formally democratic or authoritarian states can also be a place for those kind of transformative urban politics. Could you talk a little bit about the state in the remaining minutes that we have?
I think in terms of the last part there, does it matter if, does it matter to our vision of urban democracy what kind of wider political system there is or what kind of state there is? I think it doesn't matter necessarily in a theoretical or in an empirical sense, because we understand and we see these forms of democracy emerging outside of the state in the coming together of people as they learn to become a collective and learn to work collectively and develop collective goals. And that can occur in any political system. That doesn't necessitate formal political rights. Where that does become important, of course, is in a political strategic sense in terms of how easy it is to do that, how easy it is to be part of a demos, how easy it is to campaign outside of the state or in an antagonistic relation towards that state. Of course, that makes a huge difference if you're in an authoritarian state or a formal democracy. So I think that would be our way of dealing with that aspect of it. Of course, it does make a difference in terms of how easy it is to practice it, but ultimately the demos coming together can occur in any context theoretically, and it does also empirically. And in terms of this, sorry, yeah.
I know, I just wanted to jump in here because I think one should not read the book as kind of here is a state-centered democracy and here is an urban democracy and they stand in kind of a conflict to each other. I think it's I think we both acknowledge that rights and democratic rights and also institutions that provide kind of democratic spaces of engagement are necessary. And the liberal state has successfully provided those spaces, and in some liberal democracies they are now under strain. But we completely would say that's a basis or to work on. And so this kind of urban democracy that we is kind of from taken from a different angle and not in opposition to the state. I just wanted to jump in here on that. And but also I think that this idea of kind of this monolithical state is something that we want to critically reflect. So I think it really depends on where do you engage. Do you engage with the local state or do you engage with the nation state? It has different kind of opportunities and options. And of course, the resources that the state can provide or use in urban development is huge. And this is not something that emergent urban public can kind of provide themselves.
Yeah. I think maybe the last thing to say on that, I'm noticing that not that we have necessary differences, but this is so complex, this the state's relationship to democracy, that you know the nuance in it, unless you take a very simplistic view of the state, which we don't, then you can interpret it in very different ways. I think what we say in the book is that one way of interpreting what we say in the book is that the state is an important or can be an important political actor, absolutely. But as its relation to democracy itself is not a necessity for democracy itself to exist. For us, democracy is always primarily a relationship between people and places, in particular how they occupy and locate themselves in the world, and that never excludes the state. But the state isn't really the vehicle or the hope of democracy. But of course, in the modern context, the context that we have, the state has to be, is part of the political terrain, even if it doesn't define the parameters of democratic politics.
And in the book, you use concrete examples of movements and initiatives engaging with their respective states in very different ways. So maybe you could give us a couple of examples to just illustrate this theoretical point that you're making.
I think, well, we use four examples. I think I suppose the most well-known one, for at least for urban scholars, might be the Barcelona on Camus example, which emerged in the midst of the global financial crisis and how that affected Spain and housing politics and people being moved out of their housing and developed these all the kind of politics which emerged there, and then a platform emerged at these social movements and neighborhood groups, and this like the kind of theory of municipalism which seems to have emerged there or taken root there is one in which state power is sought. So the platform has taken power. You know, they've been in government for two terms in Barcelona. But it doesn't aspire only to formal state power. Indeed, it tries to transform from within, and it tries. So it takes seriously state power, and it seeks to win power. You know, occupy the institutions. I think is the slogan that people have used to make gains. So the state can do things, but the vision of democracy, which they ultimately promote, is one in which citizens are enabled or empowered to self-government through a different form of state, which is the state is almost like trying to adopt a non-sovereign politics, I think we call it in the book. Whereas in terms of partnerships, you might see public or public commons partnerships as being some kind of way of easily framing that relationship between state and citizen, which is part of the new municipalist imaginary. So I think that's one example. And another example we use is is the example of Naples, where in a similar period in the 2010s, there was this, the emergence of a kind of urban politics around contesting national politics and global politics, and this kind of self-organization as the state was in crisis, and lots of social movements occupying spaces in the city, and the local government there responding in a kind of accommodating way and enabling social movements and community groups to stay in certain spaces, providing them with the ability to occupy spaces for public projects. But the social movements themselves, in contrast to Barcelona, not seeking to gain state power. So much more in this kind of, we talk about distances to the state. So these are kind of symbolic distances to the state. So in Naples, it was much more kind of flurries of activity and engagement with the state, but seeking to stay apart from that. And in the book, we don't really take one line and say one is better than the other. We talk about also about Preston, which is really kind of ultimately not really in line with what we would say a democratic project is. It's kind of old municipalism, you know, very centered on the state as a driver of democratic opportunity for citizens. And also talk about the Jackson, Mississippi, so establishing essentially alternative systems of the everyday in the context of sort of racial capitalism. And we argue these different distances provide different opportunities, and some of them might be enabling, sometimes it might provide limits, but ultimately they're all really good illustrations of the opportunities and risks which inevitably emerge as soon as you try to engage the state. And ultimately, any democratic project will have to do that as it seeks to sustain and struggle.
Well, I think we managed to give our listeners a good impression of what to expect from your book and how rich it is and how many themes it covers. But to conclude, I wanted to ask you, having completed this huge project, what are you working on now? What are we to expect in the next years?
Well, we're not at that point that we can announce something new, but I think what we've discussed is certainly our interest in social infrastructure as a kind of also a physical, material, but also social and symbolic space or site or location, maybe as a foundation of this form of urban democracy that we imagine. And I think the concept or also the examples of social infrastructure have gained much attention over the last couple of years, but they also have rarely been theorized as a kind of a democratic instance of an emergent urban democratic project. But we have different, I think, projects in mind, and depends a bit how we want to move on. I don't know. Maybe you want to add something, Ross.
No, I think, that aspect, and maybe I think there's potential there to ask more questions of ourselves in relation to some of the arguments we made in the book, and to approach it in a different way. I mean, the book has examples, but it's really about projecting arguments and reframing these terms and sort of challenging them. So it's kind of an intervention. It might be interesting to think about those questions in a different way, in a more kind of, from the ground up, from, looking at examples in places and thinking through those questions in more situated, empirical terms. So, basically we don't know, but...
Well, this is a perfect way to end this conversation. Thank you both very much, and best of luck with the unknown projects that you will find in the future. Thank you and take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.